Welcome to the Health Tech Podcast. Here we talk about everything healthcare and technology, and I'm your host, James Summery. Hey everybody, this week I am joined by Dr. Jennifer Huberty, a leader in the digital health space, 2 decades of experience shaping the intersection of science and wellness, has been at the helm of science at Calm and Flow, and is now the driving force behind Fit Minded Inc., guiding digital health companies with a unique blend of academic insight and industry savvy. Dr. Jennifer, or Jen, shall I call you? It's a delight to have you on the podcast. Given the quality of what we've just been talking about off air, like, I dread to think the quality of this podcast when we start. It's going to be amazing. But yes, yeah, delighted to have you on. Sure. You've been clearly a leader in the digital health space for a while. Some incredible companies you've been part of, Calm, Flow Health, you know, basically household names in the health tech world, particularly here in the UK. And now blending your knowledge of science with growing your own business as well as other people's businesses, which I'm excited to get into. Mm-hmm. So I guess for the benefit of our listeners that might not have read your website word for word like I have, why don't you tell us a little bit about your story?
Well, I'll start like a little bit back when I was a child, only because I think it's interesting because it all circles to health. But I was raised by a mother who taught aerobics for a living. My dad ran a automobile business for my grandfather that he owned in LA. And my mom worked for Richard Simmons. She was at one of his very first clubs he ever had in Beverly Hills. She would drive there every day and teach aerobics. And then he opened up one in Woodland Hills. And I literally grew up in daycares at Richard Simmons Anatomy Asylum. That's what they were called. Richard Simmons Anatomy Asylum. I swear to God.
What a name.
And there was a overweight room and a regular room.
God. Like, wow.
Crazy. I know. I look back and I'm like, and my mom carried her bag in with her Michael Jackson and Madonna records, right? And she would switch records and teach her aerobics. And I was in the daycare hanging out at even 13, waiting for my dad to pick me up so she could teach aerobics. Anyway, so health and wellness was like always a part of my childhood. And I remember when I went to high school, I was like, what the heck am I going to do when I go to college? And my chemistry teacher, I loved her. And I was like, I want to do like exercise physiology. She's like, that's a lot of chemistry. And I'm like, oh, I guess I could do chemistry. And so that's what I did. I went to school for exercise physiology and I got my bachelor's, my master's and my PhD in exercise physiology. But what changed for me was when I was in my PhD, I was like, I'm basically going to be a very trained personal trainer. Like, do I want to have a PhD in personal training? Like, what the hell am I doing with this degree? And then I realized like I was super into behavior and how women specifically were participating in health behaviors and why. And I ran some interventions and started to learn a little bit about how you help people change their behaviors. And it was funny because I was saying to myself, like, I feel like we do this all wrong. I feel like women participate in health behaviors like exercise, let's say, to lose weight. And then the weight loss makes them feel better about themselves. Mm-hmm. But I actually have papers about this where I thought, shouldn't it be the other way around? Shouldn't we be teaching them to feel better about themselves so that they make a health behavior change? Mm-hmm. Like, why should it be dependent on their weight? I don't get mm-hmm. this. And when I searched the literature, it was like everything was physical, 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 physical. If you took the definition of self-worth, it was like, or self-concept was the word. It was physical, and then there was social, emotional, and what they called at the time academic, which I later coined knowledge because I developed my own tool. I validated it and published it because I was like, this is baloney. So I'm on a Stairmaster one day at 24 Hour Fitness, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm finishing up my PhD, and I'm like, what the hell? How do I get women to be physically active? And how am I going to teach self-worth? Like, how do you do that? Hmm. And so I was like, I'm going to start a book club. I literally said that to myself. I'm going to start a book club. Oprah has book clubs. I'm going to start a book club. Because remember when Oprah was doing all those book clubs? So that's what I did. I started a book club in Omaha, Nebraska. And the book club was going to be all about women who wanted to improve their health behaviors, but not weight loss as their number one goal. And they just want to learn about how to practice health behaviors and feel better about themselves. And I was going to use books that could help us do that. And I picked out the books and I developed one. This was when the newspaper was really a powerful way to get people. Somebody did an article on me in Omaha, Nebraska. This is where I had my first job at University of Nebraska, Omaha. They had a thing in the paper. University professor starts a book club to change behaviors. And I got hundreds and hundreds of calls. It was freaking crazy. I went to work like the day later and I'm like, it's like my message machine on my phone said, you have like 280 messages. And I was like, holy crap. And it was women who had called to be in my book club. So I took the 20 women and I started one. And then fast forward, by the end of the like 4 or 5 years, I had one at and in different locations all across Omaha. And I had master's students running them. I trained master's students. They would have to go through the entire book club for an entire semester to train. And when I felt they were ready, then they would lead the book clubs. And then I had them all over. And then I remember one of the most well-known researchers in my field, she caught wind of it. Like I told her about it at a conference and she's like, you should start a business. This is a business and you should write an SBIR grant. And I was like, I don't know. I don't have time. And I literally went through that first 9 years of my professional career as a professor running that quote unquote business at the university while I was teaching classes and writing grants. So it's like I always had an entrepreneur brain. I didn't have the time to execute it. And I was having like little babies at the time and whatever. But that's actually I've never really told this story before, actually. So like, this is kind of fun. But that's really where it all started, where I was like, I love business. And I love, you know, I based it on science and where the needs were with science. I actually even went through one of those angel investor things at the time and learned a lot about marketing. So that's where Fit Minded came from. This is going to get good, but like I created that book club and it was called Women Bound to Be Active, you know, bound like a book and bound together because they were social support groups. That was me, no marketing experience, making it up. And then I actually had a little bit of funds to pay a company to do it. And I had Fit Minded and the logo was a woman who was more voluptuous and had a ponytail in her hair, looked like she was exercising. Okay. So then when I started doing like the things that I'm doing now, like, before Calm, like consulting occasionally or whatever, I just used Fit Minded because it was an LLC and I got rid of the logo. And then I kind of rebranded the colors and whatever. And I kept the name when I started my business because I'm like, it's a cool name. Fit Minded. It means mental. It could be mental health. It could be anything about, it could be about your awareness. It could be about anything. If you're fit minded, you could do it. Like, I was like, this is the perfect name. So I've kept it. And then I left Omaha, Nebraska because I kind of outgrew the research I was doing there. But this is also where I started with like some entrepreneurial type things. So like I was working with the health department in Omaha, Nebraska as a professor. And there were these after school programs that were using national programs to get kids to be active or eat better or whatever. And I was like, let's see if these really work. And I would go in and I would evaluate them with monitors and all the things. And we would find out that there were like 2 minutes more of physical activity being done and no changes in nutritional, like in eating behaviors. And it's like, why are all these non-for-profits taking in all these programs that don't even work? Like they're not even serving the purpose of these kids who need something in this time because they can't go home. They have to be in after school. And I remember writing a grant for that and never getting funded. I think I tried 7 times. I was like, okay, I give up, NIH. And then I started working with Text for Baby. they were a text messaging service for pregnant women that was completely free. You would dial up and you would get text messages during your pregnancy. And I was like, why are they not giving any messages about exercise and moving your body? This rate made me very angry. So I literally cold called them and said, hey, let me write your messages. Let me test them and you can have all the messages. I will base them on behavior change theory and I will test them in an intervention and then you can have them all. I don't want them. It's for free. And they were like, absolutely. It was non-for-profit, right? So we did a study on that and we learned that texting them and using the messaging, it helped increase knowledge and education, but not necessarily behaviors. And we published that. It was a, we would call that a null finding paper because you didn't get the results that you wanted to get, which that women would be more active. And that ended up having me as the associate editor for Translational Behavioral Medicine because they were giving me kudos for the fact that I was publishing null findings. Everybody's like, don't publish that. And I'm like, no, I'm publishing it because people need to know that if you text women this much, it's too much. If you text them this much, it's okay. Like, how are we going to learn that if I don't tell you that what I thought was going to work didn't work? So that was like all my, you know, business sense. Right. And then when I was in Omaha, I had a stillborn baby. My daughter Rain would be 13. She was full term. She was born 2 days before her due date. Just a super traumatic event. Obviously they say that stillbirth is the most traumatic event a woman can go through. Definitely changed my life. Has taken me a long time to get where I am, like till today to get where I am, right? Like every day is another day. But what happened there is I started to like rethink what I was doing. So not rethink, but like I started to branch out a little bit more. So I was like, I was going to therapy, which was doing me no good. It was like ripping a Band-Aid off every week, rehashing what happened to me and crying all over again. And then, you know, getting better for 7 days and then going in and talking. It was just horrible. And I remember my counselor said, go to yoga. And I was like, I am not going to yoga. It is not exercise. I'm an exercise physiologist and I exercise. I am not going to yoga. And, I went to 24 Hour Fitness the first day I went to yoga to do the Stairmaster for 45 minutes before I went to yoga because I was convinced it wasn't going to be an exercise. And I went to this studio, it was Power Yoga, and I was in for my life. It was horrible. I mean, it was horrible. It was really hard. There was no music. You were listening to your breath. It was torture. At the time, I thought it was torture. Now I crave it, right? I want to go all the time. But I started doing yoga and then I was like, wow, if I could do yoga and that makes me feel better, then maybe I could help other women feel better. I ended up partnering with Udaya, U-D-A-Y-A. They are a yoga, online yoga. They're from Santa Monica. The guy who owns it produced all the Sylvester Stallone and some other movies in Bulgaria. Anyway, super nice guy. I randomly wrote him an email and asked him for 100 memberships for free and he gave them to me. And then he invited me to Bulgaria and I went and I was in yoga videos. So if you go online right now, you can find me in those yoga videos. Anyway, so I did research with them and we found that women who had stillbirth, which this was my first NIH funds. I remember everyone's like, you're going to write an NIH grant for like $700,000 for yoga and stillbirth. You're never getting funded. And I remember the program officer telling me after my first try, I got a really bad score. And he literally was like, don't bother resubmitting this. And I hung up the phone and I closed my office door and I sobbed and sobbed and sobbed because, you know, it was also my daughter and everything. And I was like, you know what? Screw this. I'm writing it. And I wrote it and it got funded. So, wow. I did that project with them and I was able to show that online yoga helps PTSD in these women. So then I was like, wow, like I've done all these things with businesses. And I started to practice meditation. And then I moved to Arizona and I was like, oh my God, my yoga teacher's in Omaha from Nebraska. What am I going to do? And I remember someone saying to me, Jen, the yoga is inside of you. The yoga has nothing to do with your teacher. And I was like, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I was so attached to having someone helping me through my journey with my daughter, mm-hmm. Rain, that I couldn't see that it was me that was doing the yoga, not him. Anyway, so I came to Phoenix and I started practicing meditation and I started using the Calm app. I was like, oh, snap, this thing is working. Wait, I need to learn more about this. And I, again, I cold called them. They had no employees. They were like in an apartment building. And they actually said they would partner with me and give me some memberships. And then that fell through because someone was working there that didn't work there anymore. And nobody knew about what we had conversed about. So I went to 10% happier. And they go, yeah, we'll do the deal with you. We'll do some research with you. And then Calm out of the blue one day called me and said, hey, we've noticed some notes and did you still want to do this? And I was like, yeah. And that's how I ended up with a paper with 10% happier and Calm in the same study.
Wow.
Because it just worked itself out and it was in cancer patients. So anyway, then my stuff happened with Calm and about a year and a half in, I never talked to anyone at Calm, like nobody. I just got the memberships and that was it. And I called them up one day and I was like, hey, I'm finding some really good findings with your app. I want to come and tell you about it. And they were like, okay, but you have to fly here yourself and whatever. So I flew myself there and I gave a presentation and I came home. And the same day I got a call from the COO and he was like, can you come back in like 2 or 3 days and give a presentation to a group of people? And I was like, sure. And then he was like, we'll put you up. We'll fly you.
I was going to say, yeah, if you paid for the flights this time. Yeah.
Yeah. And I flew there and I gave my talk. I started all my talks with my daughter because that's what brought me to yoga and meditation. Mm-hmm. And then the growth officer, which God, I love her. She stood up at the end. I didn't know she was the chief growth officer though. And she's like, anybody who's in academe or even, I don't know, even at med centers would understand how amazing this is. She stood up and said, is there anything we can do to help you? Do you need financial support? And I'm like, oh my God, you're asking me as a professor who's like, has no money and writing grants. Like you're, you know, like it's going to be the death of you. And I was like, this is not happening right now. And then I started growing their research. And then she's like, do you want to lead science? And I was like, absolutely. And then they were like, are you going to leave your job? And I said, no, you don't want me to. I have affiliations. I have whatever. So I basically worked two jobs for like 4 years.
Wow.
I was working as an ASU professor, busting chops. And then I was the director of science at Calm. And then I wrote a grant, another grant with Calm, and I ended up getting it. It was $2.5 million. And the day I got that grant, I was like, toodles, wow. I'm leaving the university. I'm going full blown to Calm. And I left. That was a great day.
I bet.
Yeah. So that's how I ended up at Calm. Long journey.
I want to go right. But I know there's more to your story, which we'll come to. But whilst we're at this pause point, I want to go right back to when you had the book clubs, I should say.
Okay.
When you put that ad out, and I'm just interested here, right? I'm in marketing and this is an interesting, you know, behavioral science and marketing sort of crossover. When you put that ad out, which said, if I remember correctly, it's for women that want to exercise but don't want to lose weight as their primary goal. Why did that get so many people apply for it? What was it about that advert that I don't know if you ever, like, did you decode this as to, like, why was that so popular? Why was that such a vacuum for people?
Yeah, I'll tell you why. Like, I mean, I didn't like test it or anything, but it's because it gives women like release and like, I can do this and I don't have to have this goal that I don't know if I'm going to achieve. And if I don't achieve, I'm going to feel like crud about myself. That's why I gave them an out. Like, you can come still talk about health behaviors and you can be supported by other women and your weight doesn't have to be the focus. Like it always is, basically. That's really what it was. You know, I did some qualitative research and with some of these women, and like at the end of the day, women that were changing behaviors were doing so because, so this whole self-worth thing came from some other intervention I was doing where I followed up with women. It's like, why did you not keep doing this program that you were in for 12 weeks or whatever? And the answer was the same. The women who were adhering, if you will, did so because of the way they felt about their self and their self-worth. And those were the words they used. So that's what helped them to do it. So that's what made me think we need to teach self-worth before we slam them with, you need to lose weight and you need to do this and you need to do that.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So like one of the books we used was Nora Ephron's book. She's passed, but she was really funny. And this book was called I Feel Bad About My Neck. And she had a section in there where she talks about women and their big bags and how big women's purses are and what the heck do you put in that purse? Like, why do you carry around a blow dryer and like all the ridiculous things that women carry around in their purse? And so for me, I would take that and say, okay, ladies, funny chapter, ha ha. But also, what do you carry around in your purse, in your head? What are your stories that you're telling yourself about your weight and about yourself as a woman and how you should and shouldn't be? What are you carrying around? What's your baggage that you're carrying around? And we would have those discussions in the group. So it was very much a enlightened, you know, also like take a look at the mirror, also self-reflection, also forgiveness. I mean, we would write letters to partners about the support that they needed or their children or whoever. I would have them write letters and share them so that they could practice going home and asking for, I need to make dinner at 6:30 tonight because instead of 6, because I want to take some time for me and nobody's going to die and everything's going to be okay. You're allowed to take care of yourself. Like those were the things that we were doing, which to be honest, women still need right now. It's not like indeed. It's any different.
No, indeed. Indeed. So, there's such a huge element of community in that as well, isn't there? And like you're selling so much that isn't just a book club. In fact, you're hardly selling a book club at all. You're selling everything that that book club actually brings. It's funny as well. It reminds me of, there was a quote I heard on a podcast the other day, which was that, what was it? You only want to get rich because you're expecting to feel a certain emotion that money gives you. I was thinking about that, like
it's an attachment.
It's so true. Like you're only just in search of feeling a certain way at the end of all this anyway. Like whatever it is that you're seeking because you're assuming some emotion at the end of it, be that satisfaction, be that relief, be that, I don't know, whether you want to feed other desires and pleasures and all the rest
but
of it,
you don't
what
need.
That brings you, but which you don't
and
need.
You don't need any of it. You can bring that to yourself in any moment if you so choose. You have to do the work. It's not, it's not like, you know, like, let's be real. It's not like I'm going to sit here and go, I feel like I just got $1 million. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like
no,
all the
right.
feelings. You do have to do the internal work, right? Because life is going on around us. But
yeah,
if you're willing to do it, you know, like I don't want to say this, like, but I feel happy 99% of the time. Like, I don't really, that's just me personally, but I also, like, I last week I felt disconnected from myself. I was feeling a little uneasy because, you know, depending on my business, if it's fast or slow, it's like, I really love the fast, right? And if I have way too many calls that I can take and way too many things on my plate, it's like, yes, I'm killing it, you know? And it was kind of like slow because we had just finished a bunch of projects and nothing's changed financially, just slower. And I started to feel this disappointment and I started to ask myself, what is this? Like, I literally had to say, what is this emotion, Jen? It's not sad. What is it? It's not sad and happy. Get deeper. And so I started to do that. And then I was like, well, the only way I'm really going to be able to get at this is to tap into myself. So I journaled. I journal to my soul. I know that sounds funny, but I journal to my soul. My soul has a name. It came to me in a dream and I journal to her. And it's like talking to your inner child, right? It's like, you know, what is this feeling that I'm having or what are these things? And literally out of the page came the answers. And it only took me a few minutes because I am tapped into myself and I do have these practices. So it doesn't take me too long, but like the next morning I woke up and that feeling was gone.
What did you identify that feeling as out of interest? Because that's incredibly relatable, by the way, that you know, when you're too fast and you're too busy and that, when it slows down is when you, it's a sense of almost like not anxiety, almost trepidation or loss. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, it's like, is this like a little bit of worry? And also like, but it was more of me saying like, you know, to myself, you know, why do I always have to be going fast? And literally the answer was like rest. Like it's okay to rest, number one. And number two, like you already did all the things. You're already doing all the things. The things are done. It's just going for you now. Like you can't keep doing your life. Like you're doing, it's showing up for itself. You started a company a year and a half ago and you're funding like two full-time employees. That's a lot to say, right? So it's like, what, Jen, what else do you need to know that it's the doing is happening? Relax. It's okay. It's time to relax. And I actually went to a breathwork session the next day for an hour. And that's exactly what came is it's time to rest. It is time to rest. The doing is doing. And letting go of like these evil thoughts that like that they're evil thoughts that have nothing to do with you. It's laughable how evil they are and get rid of them. So it's like, but this is work to do, right? It's not like I have to get in my car and drive to the breathwork class and drive home and tell my husband I'll be around later and maybe miss something. Like there's things that have to happen to do that, but people have to do that.
Yeah. And actually, I want to talk about that a little bit, doing the work, because it's not only those things practically, actually, for me, and I know for other entrepreneurs and things like that, and this relates to calm, actually, and something that I want to move on to with research in this space. But you've got to kind of accept an identity as someone that A, doesn't know it all, B, needs help, C, is willing to go and get it, D, believes that getting help will actually change how I feel, and believe in these concepts that you might not have 100% belief in yet, and you might even need to research and do that work even to become okay that these things might indeed help you. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of actual work to do for people that goes beyond simply driving there and, you know, I've got to sit still for half an hour and meditate and the rest of it. There's actually a lot of identity work that people need to do. But the thing that I wanted to talk about here with regard to like doing the work as well is that, let's say we're talking about meditation or yoga as a form of meditation. Like, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but my belief, given what I've done in this for myself personally, is that functional MRI studies have shown that brain structure does indeed change with consistent meditation, with practices like yoga. And actually, it is quite literally in the work that the structure of the brain will change. This isn't something you can do one session of and you reap the rewards and reap the benefits. This is something that you need to put time into. So I guess my question here is, when you were directing science at Calm, be it these functional MRI studies or be it different studies in different things or whatever it is, what were the sorts of things that you were researching and directing here? What were the practices of science that you were directing? Because I imagine that what Calm was trying to do was, I guess, in some way justify the product, the technology, the practices of meditation in some form, but also probably trying to sell and do different things and create more impact with what they were trying to do. So yeah, I'm interested in your thoughts on that mixed bag of stuff.
Yeah, so there were a lot of things that I was doing in terms of directing science, which is like what has allowed me to have my own company, Fit Minded, today. Because literally the day I sat down and I was getting ready to open my own company, I literally wrote out every single thing I had ever done in five years. That's how I came up with my services. It was just like a vomit of like all the things. Some of the bigger things that I think, companies are interested in knowing about and things like that is like, so for example, okay. So when I first got there, they knew nothing about who was using their app. And mainly because a lot of companies are in the same boat. They don't really ask demographics. You know, you ask two or three questions when someone comes into an app and that's it. That's all you get. Yeah, Otherwise, you're going to lose them, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like you can start saying, what gender are you? What race, ethnicity are you? How much income do you make? And it also is off-putting. No one wants to go into something and all of a sudden you want to know about me. Like, that's rude. So the marketing team was putting together a survey and I was like, can I look at it? And they showed me it and I was like, oh, this isn't really going to get you anything. So I was like, would you mind if I helped write the survey? And they were like, absolutely, take it, do it. So I wrote the survey where I was asking self-reported questions about why did you come to Calm? Obviously demographics, but why did you come to Calm? Like, how has Calm helped you? Granted, it's self-report, but who cares? They didn't have any knowledge of anything. Yeah, right. We had like 11,000 people complete the survey and publish the paper immediately on what are our users look like and how are, you know, why are they here and what are they doing? And that's been, paper's been cited a lot. And then another, this is kind of funny. So Michael and Alex, the CEOs at the time, they're the nicest guys. I don't talk to them anymore, but like they were just so nice. I really loved working with them. Such good humans. Anyway, I was like, I remember saying to Alex, I'm like, they were like, oh, you know, we're an app that helps you sleep. And I'm like, how do you know that? And they're like, well, Matthew McConaughey is helping women sleep. They're telling us. And I'm like, yeah, they are telling you that. And I'm sure it's great. But like, we don't really know if you can help people sleep. And they're like, well, how do you find that out? And I was like, well, you have to do a randomized control. Like literally, if you want to go that far down the road, you got to do a randomized control trial in sleep disturbed adults. And then you have to compare it to control group. And they were like, oh, how much would that cost? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I can probably do it pretty resourcefully. So yeah. Well, if you submit it to the NIH, you could get $2.5 million, but it'll take you 7 years to get there and your product won't even exist anymore. Anyway, so we did the study and literally Calm reduced sleep disturbance in sleep disturbed adults. So that was another big study. And then the other thing, and this was a lot of these people aren't there anymore, but there was a gentleman there that was the CMO and he had had cancer actually. And he had worked at the NIH. He was a cool dude. At first we didn't click, but then we clicked. And he was like, Jen, what can I do for you? Like, what do you need help so you can get us the outcomes that you need? I was like, get me a big box company. I need a big box company. You need to get me a deal. We need B2B outcomes because D2C is not like we have the outcomes for that already. We need B2B. So he got me into a big box company and I wrote a couple papers on return on investment for Calm. It's, you know, a lot of that company, every company is this like, it's like the people that are there, right? Like it's, you know, people make up, that's the company. Anyway, he was awesome. He's moved on. He's like a president in another mental health company now. But so that was another study. I also was Before they did mood symptom tracking, I suggested mood symptom tracking, but not in those terms. But I gave them a presentation about how there's nothing tangible for meditation. So to get people to do things, you have to give them something to show that they're having improvements. And you can't really go, oh, I go to the refrigerator and I go to open it and I'm more mindful and I realize I'm not hungry and I turn around and I have a glass of water. Like, that's meditation that does that, right? Or my son is 14 and driving me absolutely bananas right now and thinks he is so experienced and I can either lose my poop right now or I can be non-reactive and speak to him kindly. That's meditation. You can't really measure that on an app, right? How do you get the general public to see that? And especially if they, most people don't even know if they're doing meditation right. So it was like, you know, so then we did the mood symptom tracking. I also helped them with the languaging for behavioral languaging for like questions to go on to different things in the app. Like I would sit with the product team or the content team and stuff. So there were a lot of things behind the scene that I wasn't just running studies. And that's the thing now that I have my own company. Someone will say, you know, can you write a grant for me? How much do you charge for that? Or can you do a study for us? How much do you charge for that? And it's like, I will do a needs assessment. I will build a strategy. If those things are in the strategy, because that's what's right for your company, absolutely, I can do that. But no, you can't hire me to do a grant. No, you can't hire me to do a research study. I don't do that. I'm not going to come in and just do something. For me, that's a Band-Aid. Like these people like that I work with, CEOs, they have these big dreams, just like Michael and Alex and Calm. And some of them flop and some of them don't. And it's my job to help them succeed, to be their biggest supporter, to help them make informed decisions. And most recently, I don't know, have you read the book by Rick Rubin, The Creative Act?
No, I've not.
Oh man, that book is good. You got to read it. But he talks about, you know, everything's art and like, it's amazing. I just love that book. But, you know, I literally see every company like a canvas, right? Like, I don't know what I'm going to draw. I haven't gone to the company. What colors are they offering me? What tools, what methods to build my art piece? You know, like, I don't even know, right? So, and most recently, I don't know, who asked me, somebody asked me, like, if there was one thing you would want to know from a CEO. And it was this girl in sociology, mental health. Anyway, I said, the best thing to ask CEOs for me is what are your biggest fears? Because if I can figure out some of their biggest fears, there's things in science that we can do to help them make a decision about the things that they're fearful of. And so that's kind of how, like, this is how I ebb and flow and grow. So like, I wasn't there 3 years ago, but now I want to know your fears, man. Tell me them, because I'm going to help you. So anyway, all this comes from the mindfulness stuff. It all comes from like awareness.
Yeah, yeah.
To me.
With that framework, I'm interested. So how big was Calm when you entered and got in there? Sounds like it was very early on.
20 people.
Wow. 20,
I don't know. Like they had just moved out of an apartment building.
Yeah.
Or something. They were in a smaller building. Yeah.
From what you observed then, why was Calm successful?
Number one, you know, someone was saying, somebody wrote something the other day. I don't know. I read so many things on LinkedIn and half the stuff I'm like, And then half of it, I'm like, ooh, this is really good, you know? But someone was saying about how, you know, these companies, these startups, they grow them with people who are like, they can do everything, right? They're like, one day they're the janitor and the next day they're the CTO, right? Like, they can do it all. And then once they get established, they let go of those people and they hire like, you know, I could see how that happens, but also at Calm, they had some pretty, if I can say, badass people working there. Like the people that were there when I was first there that are now, most of them are now gone, but like, a lot of them are doing very well for themselves. And granted, they have XCOM on their name, but they're not just like working jobs, like developing their own apps. Like one of the gentlemen who was, he had a PhD and he did data sci, and he has his own app now with an engineer that was at Calm back in the day, who was also the engineer who helped me build my control group that I use for all my studies and I still get to use. So like, there's some pretty smart, talented people that were there. So that would be one thing. Two, I'm really big into like manifestation and like put it out there, right? Like, this is going to sound funny, but I, you know, I'll just say I'm 49 and I have been an Usher fan since I was like 19, 20 years old, right?
Excellent.
You know who Usher is? Yeah.
Indeed.
Okay. Fully yeah. Aware. And he's really popular right now because he was at the Super Bowl. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure, calls them day oneers. The people that liked him from day one are day oneers. I'm a day oneer. Okay. Just want you to know. Hopefully Usher's going to listen to this podcast.
But sure
he was talking last week on like a post about how he used to walk around with his mom and tell everybody he's going to be an artist. And his mom would be like, why do you keep saying that? You're not even, and he'd be like, cause I am. And if I don't believe it, who else is going to believe it? And like basically how he manifested that. Right. So I'm like really, really big into that. So I used to go to San Francisco to the meetings at Calm. I would go like every 2 to 3 months. And Michael and Alex, man, they were on fire. I always had goosebumps. They had all these big dreams and they were like making them happen. Like they were just so inspiring. That's another thing that made them successful. 110%. I give them kudos for the way they believed in themselves and their product and what they were doing. So it was talent, and those were the two biggest things, I think. Obviously, they made smart decisions. They went down the celebrity road with the branding. So everybody knows they're Calm because of the branding. They went double down on branding. Mm. It's like, how can you go wrong? You know?
It's really interesting what you said about the people at Calm then go on to like found their own companies and that kind of thing. And it's interesting to me in the context of what you describe as what you call manifestation, right? There's something as well, just I think about belief. Like when you've been in a company and you've seen, and yes, you can observe how they dealt with product and how they dealt with finding the value propositions and how they sold and and you can learn those practical skills from people. I think though, it's a factor of good leadership, isn't it? Like inspiration, as you just talked about, and inspiring people to follow you, but then also inspiring them to just go and start their own businesses. We, you know, in the UK, we've had a huge health tech company go down. They were in the US as well, called Babylon. And, you know, they went down in flames. But when you look at the roster that they had of individuals and what they have gone on to do, you know, the CEO of Babylon is well known to have been incredibly good at sales, incredibly good at inspiration, incredibly good at vision, like all those things that has galvanized like a huge amount of people to tackle what was at the time a wild assumption that a computer could be a doctor and a doctor could be a computer. Like an absolutely crazy thing to have said back then, which then evolved to making healthcare affordable and accessible to everybody. And you know, that vision and language changed certainly, but you know, the initial premise like ruffled a heck of a lot of feathers, and it was truly disruptive, but galvanized, like honestly, it's like a who's who of health tech when you look at like ex-Babylon people here in the UK with all of the startups they've gone on to start, all of the leadership positions they've gone on to take and the things that they are doing. Like it is incredible. And I think there are these characters, aren't there? These characters where, you know, they've been important, and we're lucky in healthcare because these types of characters don't go on to form hedge funds and they don't go on to form these companies that, you know, create more wealth for people with wealth or whatever it is, right? We're fortunate that those types of characters in healthcare turn around and inspire more people to build more technology to do more good. And that is a beautiful thing. And that story that you told there about, you know, an engineer and a PhD, a domain expert and a tech expert, the person who can see the path, the person who can build the product that, you know, sends you down the path, like that ideal pairing of individuals is where else are you going to find that better than in a fast growing, successful startup? You're of course going to find those people, because they're literally just a few seats away from you or a department away from you. And it's what I tell a lot of the university students that ask me where to find a co-founder. It's like, they're at the other end of an email. Like, just make up a few names at the start before the at symbol, just like pot luck. Just like try something before the at symbol at your university. Like, geez,
that's
like at harvard.edu. Like, Jesus, just email some people. Like, it. But yeah, at startups, it's there for you, isn't it, as well? And that coupled with the inspiration of an incredible founder, like, it's crazy what that does. Like, it really is for what, especially from what I've seen in the space recently, the amount of startups that have been created. So yeah, I don't know what that is in behavioral science terms, like inspiration and leadership. I don't know what that is. It's a collection of things, isn't it? And it's human nature, of course. We're tribal beings. You want to follow the person that we think is going to lead us to safety or to lead us to somewhere better or whatever it is. But yeah, it's super interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're saying this because, like, you know, here I am trying to, like, you know, help these CEOs and, you know, I'm involved with a couple of companies right now. They're definitely growing and they're going to do well. Like, you know, there's no doubt about it. And I'm watching them and observing and also helping, right, make decisions or whatever. So I'm doing that in this supporting role and using science strategy. But then because I have my own company, I'm also a CEO. It's really weird. It's like this back and forth. So it's like I just hired a chief of staff like 6 weeks ago. We just announced it on LinkedIn today, actually. And it's a lot of money to hire a chief of staff. And I was like, you know what? We're just going to invest in this. And like, I need this person because I can't be doing all these things that I'm doing. I need to be doing my job. And so it's like interesting how now it's like I'm helping these CEOs and I'm watching them how they lead and they do things. But I'm also a CEO. I'm trying to grow a company. I'm trying to figure out what my growth model is, right? I'm literally just now working on, you know, a year and a half. Okay, great. It's still good. But it's like, do I want to think about, you know, like a sales, like so something organized, you know, and maybe a marketing strategy, like maybe at some point, you know, like, and so we're starting to get more business-ish and it's like, I'm like watching myself be these CEOs that I'm trying to support and trying to go back and forth between these two things. And then also be a leader. So I'm like, I have scientists who work for me. I have a postdoc, I have a chief of staff, and then I have two other doc students who are excelling and like graduating any day now. And it's interesting too, because like what we were saying before we started is like, I made up the term fractional chief science officer, right? Like I literally made it up. Like I took it, stole it, whatever. I've noticed some other scientists come out with that term since then. And it's like I was saying earlier to you before this filming is like, It's not something you can like, you can't go to school for it. It's not something that's like taught. It's literally the streets. Like I learned on the streets, right? I learned on the streets of community-based participatory research and being in sliding fee scale situations and by cold calling people and asking them to do things and giving me things and taking a chance and then sitting back at Calm like a sponge and having a chief growth officer that was killer and trusted me and loved everything that I was doing. I'm very fortunate and rode the wave of that. And so like all those things, you can't bottle that up and then pitch it to somebody. It's like a way that I think that it's like indescribable sometimes. Like my chief of staff will be like, Jen, I can see your brain when you're in these meetings. It is crazy. She's like, I don't even know how you're like listening. Because you can tell your brain is always on. So it's like, I'm in this situation now where it's like, I'm trying to lead scientists, empower them and female mostly, but it's like empower them to be their own people and follow their own passion and instinct, but also try to train them to kind of do some of this stuff. It's super interesting how this all works. It's very interesting. Again, we come back to you have to be self-aware. How do you do all this stuff if you are not self-aware. I could just go around being abrasive and pushing people around all the time. Mm. Or I can tap into myself. I can have compassion. I can have grace. I can have patience. It always works out better that way.
Mm. Yeah. And I think I imagine it's frustrating for some people as well to possibly be listening to this podcast thinking like, oh, I just want some real actionable advice here of how I go and become a chief science officer or a director of science or this type of thing. But it's one of those things, isn't it? It's going to look completely different no matter where you go, because each company that even has that all titles are made up, let alone this, which is like very newly made up. It could mean something utterly different depending on the company's stage, what the company's doing, or just frankly, just what the company needs in that moment. Like you might be directing a certain research paper, which is going to change everything once you prove a certain hypothesis to be true or not. That might activate an entire sales strategy. That might be the sole focus of the entire thing. A different director of strategy, as you say, might be managing a whole suite of scientists in a wet lab or doing something similar. Like it could look something very different. And so your point there becomes really valid about knowing one's self and knowing what you like and knowing what you want to do with your time. And then if there's a role that happens to be called that you seem right for, then fine. But chasing an arbitrary title like that doesn't sound like the best idea, especially not trying to retrofit yourself into a role like that.
Yeah, I mean, and that's true, like what you're saying, different scientists in different roles. But even like I was saying, I have, let's say, XX companies. Science looks different in every single one of those. Yeah, there's nothing identical between them. I don't go in and do the same thing at every company. It's just, it doesn't exist, you know? And sometimes I'm like a CEO.
Yeah, no, of course. But just out of interest, for let's say, scientists that are listening that have an interest in technology, they might have an interest in mental health, they might have an interest in women's health, they might have an interest in any specific technology, maybe a specific clinical area, like they might have a specific interest and they might actually know of a few companies in that space. If those individuals that are listening that fit that category do genuinely believe that they would be incredibly fulfilled working in a startup like that and actually providing scientific value, and they're willing to do that in many different capacities, what is your advice actually about approaching companies like that? I mean, what's the best way to even do that? And how would you go about even showing value to those types of companies? Is it a case of like, learning as much as you can and trying to go with your own value proposition of here's how I could add value? Or do you more advocate for kind of slowly building network and being in and around them, meeting them informally? Like what's the best way for them to actually go and even think about getting a job at one of these places? The reason I ask is because breaking into health tech is such a big topic, and I'm so frustrated with myself because I do not have the answer. I don't know the best way, because you're right, it's Wild West.
Yeah. And I don't think I have the answer either, in the sense that it is tough to do. I mean, like I would say, number one, you have to put yourself out there. So somehow you got before, like if you're in a scientist situation, before you can even go and like say, I could help you do this, you got to have something to stand on. So it's just like when you're growing up as a scientist, you got to publish things before people will consider you a scientist. Cause I remember when I was first out of school, I wanted to go on like a presentation tour. I wanted to give presentations about self-worth and physical activity and all that stuff. And I kept getting the same thing. You need more publications. You need a book. You need something. You need whatever. Right. So it's like, you have to have something to stand on. That's what happens with some of the young scientists who are like, going from a PhD to a postdoc in industry, and they might have like a 3-month postdoc and they think they're ready for industry. It's like, no, that's not right. Like it does, in my opinion, this is my opinion.
Right.
Everybody has their own. So I just want to be super, but they're not ready because who I think would be ready or is ready is able to think business strategy. Like, because so many times I've gone into 2 companies so far. No, 3, sorry. 3 companies so far that I've had to literally clean up shop. Wait, actually 4. So two of them have science teams. They have complete teams, and I'm going in there and cleaning everything up. I'm helping people work shoulder to shoulder. I'm getting everything organized. They're like, one company's like doing random science that has nothing to do with business priorities, and no one can figure out why they're not getting where they need to go. So hunkering them in, and even like, I'm trying to educate them, but I'm still getting emails about, let's do this. And like, what does that have to do with sales? That's not going to get the company, right? Like, so again, you know, or another company, it's like, what have you been doing the last 5 years? I'm not sure what you're paying all your scientists for. What are they doing? Like, what the heck? You know, I'm reading white papers going, you cannot publish this. Like, do not tell this story. This is not going to help you. It's just going to set you back. So that's been super interesting. And so that's what happens is scientists go into a company and they're just thinking about science. They're not thinking about the strategy. Now, keep in mind, that was me. It's not like I knew it from the start. When I came to Calm, I wanted to do research with cancer and Calm. And I did brand, I did do all the things for business because I was a sponge and I started to grow it, right? No big deal. But when I first came in there, I was like, oh, cool. I could do my own research, Jenta. Come. And it's like, it did go over well. And I'll tell you that there's still some things that were developed and I think that looking back, that things probably would have been different because I had niched a market, and I was telling them that then, and I'm advising other companies similarly on how to niche a market and differentiate yourself. But again, some companies, Calm included, okay, they are moving so fast on the train. Like the train goes by so fast. So there's no slowing down to do some of these things. And that's why now with health tech, it's like, slow down. There's so many competitors in the mental health, digital health space. Slow down. Differentiate yourself, build the science around it. But again, you take a scientist who's been trained in a university and you throw them in to differentiate a company.
Yeah. So I guess what you're saying is it's the value of a true expert, isn't it? A value of a true expert that truly understands the research within a niche, but actually broadly across that niche enough so that they can think more critically about it rather than just accepting of the facts and trying to, I guess, impose their scientific knowledge of the space. It's not that. It's actually, you need to critically appraise the scientific knowledge of the space to now think about where are the gaps that we can now pull in the business. So it's like, and then where does the science and the business align? Can we prove something that improves sale? Yeah. So I get what you're saying. So it's not, this isn't a straight out of university job, is it?
That's right. I had a guy who was at a small startup in a very small area, and he had real lived experience of the same thing, the same outcomes that this company was focused around. And he wants to be, you know, growing himself as a scientist in the field. And he's like, oh, I should grow here and grow here and grow here. It's like, no, look at where you are right now. You're differentiated just because you have a real life experience and you're at a company doing this that's super, super small, but you could grow yourself in this niche. There's enough out there in this one niche. I don't know any other scientists doing that. And you know it better than anyone else. You know why? Real lived experience. And then the science on top of that, it's like someone can talk to me about postpartum depression, PTSD, stress and pregnancy, anything. And I will real lived experience and also all the research and publications I've had. So I said to him, stay where you are, keep differentiating yourselves. And that's the biggest thing I tell scientists. What's your differentiator? You better find one. Same thing I tell companies. What's your differentiator? Nobody cares if you reduce anxiety, if you're not different than anybody else, because there's so many tools to quote unquote reduce anxiety, but we don't really even know if they do actually reduce anxiety.
It's funny because it's almost a business principle as well, isn't it? Because who cares if there's another marketing agency that does healthcare? But what if there was one started by an anesthetics and intensive care doctor? You know, like immediately I was differentiated.
That's right.
And it makes a difference, you know, because our ability to have an opening meeting with people and actually even in the biotech space, talk about like RNA and transcriptases and, you know, the proteome and all these things, it just rolls off and all of a sudden.
But you have proven yourself in a number of different ways. In other words, when you first started doing this entrepreneurial side, right, you had to like show, you had to show that you were doing something. So like when I first left Calm and started my own company, the first thing I thought of is like, again, this is imposter syndrome, of course, because everyone does this to themselves, but it's like, how am I like, everyone's going to think, oh, she did that at Calm. Well, Calm's so different. How's she going to do it everywhere else? And, you know, I published like 45 papers for them, but I've been out a year and a half in my own company. And I think I've published 15 to 20 papers across the companies that I've had. So it's like, Now I can say, okay, I did it there. I can do it at a mom and pop shop, and I can do it at a Series B, and I can do it at a pre-series. Like, give me the situation, I'll make it happen. Right. But you have to prove yourself also out in the different markets. So that's the biggest thing, is I'm still having to be a scientist and show my effects, right? Like, I got to have some numbers. I got to have some impact in these companies for me to say to this company, I can do that for you. Now they know, right? Now they understand. So for you, you've done it here, and then you did it here, and now you're doing it here. It's like, oh, well, this makes sense. This is what this guy does. So you see what I'm saying? So that, again, takes talent and a different way of thinking just to have that.
In our last few minutes, I want to talk to you about what you're doing now a bit more specifically. Science strategies to help CEOs is a phrase that you've said and that I've read on your website. What are science strategies that help CEOs? What does that even mean?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm working on that on my value proposition. I'll get back to you. Just kidding. I'm joking. So I think what at the end of the day is like, you know, again, I've mentioned this, but helping CEOs differentiate themselves in their market. And so there's a lot of ways to do that. But it's also understanding that when you make business decisions, you want to do them in the most informed way. That doesn't mean I have to do a research study and look at the effects to make a decision. It just means I need to do my due diligence. So for example, my app does this. Okay. Well, the customers that are coming to your app, are you solving their problems? You're assuming their problem is what you say you're solving, but have you asked them why they're coming? Have you asked them the benefits they're having? You could say that you're reducing, let's say, anxiety, but they're actually coming for the social community. They're actually coming because it's a hip, cool place to be. I don't know, but you have to do the homework. And you have to figure that out, because what happens is there's broader markets to reach to, and there's a better way to be within your market, right? So customers is a big thing. Sales, like, I am a salesperson and I'm selling to you, and you're telling me why you can't buy my service or product. What do I do with that? Those are called pain points, right? Well, what do I do with that? I need some information from somebody so I can overcome the pain point. What do I say back to this person? Well, no, we're good. You should trust us. It's like, no, at the end of the day, you know, there's potentially data or other ways in which to have like a rebuttal to these pain points. So you're still selling. And I'm telling you, this is coming. Like right now, a lot of CEOs are like, what's the point in science? Investors don't care. Right now, investors are still very heavily based on retention and engagement, because that makes them money, right? If I'm going to give you $1 million, I better get five back.
It's the best indicator, right? At that sort of level of investment, yeah. You can argue.
That's right. But that's right, 100%. But it's. I was just talking to a VC yesterday. It's going to change. Like, right. It is changing, but it's going to keep changing. And a lot of people who have been on this retention engagement are going to have no outcomes. And then that's it. Like, they're not going to accept anybody else in line unless they have data.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, you better come with some numbers, because like, and I see companies doing this all the time. hiring retention and engagement salespeople. And I just want to go, oh my God.
Yeah.
Why are you doing that? You need a behavioral scientist.
Chief daily active user officer. Yeah.
Are you going to go to their house and remind them to use the app and then take care of their kids and then help them? You know, like, no, you have to have behaviors, whatever it is that your audience or your market calls for.
Yeah. And in the, and you know, in their defense, of course, they're just pandering to whatever's going to get the next round of funding. Of course, if they're founding the company, they've got that desire to actually make the impact, like you'd hope anyway, like, you know, I'm sure it is for 99.9%. It's just that, you know, yeah, chief daily active user officer is probably just a very necessary thing to get to Series A. But you're right. If the, well, you tell me, if the research is becoming an asset, and of course the, yeah, by proxy, then of course the data is, right? So, That's a wonderful shift. That's an ideal shift to happen, because if it actually becomes about the science, then we're talking about a shifting quality here. It's not just those who are loudest with their getting their first 1,000 users that are then going to get the next round of funding. If it can actually be about who got their first 1,000 outcomes, positive outcomes, positive clinical outcomes, then it becomes slightly different. And it actually affects who's going to get that investment.
That's right. But remember, like, it's the customer at the end of the day. So if we're in mental health, if we're supposed to be solving mental health and making mental health better, we have to do a better job. We have to do what they need and want, and they don't always know. So you got to keep trying and testing what I call bootlegging things until you get a bite, and then you throw it in your product. You don't just make something and then, because we're on a quick train and we want to make, I totally get that. I can respect it too, right? We have to, those people have to pay their bills. Those people have kids that are, or partners or whatever it is. So everybody at the end of the day has responsibilities and needs. But also we have to do our due diligence. Like, one of the companies I work with is a measurement-based care model. And no, it is not ideal to get somebody to fill something out every 30 days. But they're doing the best care that way because that's what the numbers are telling them. And that's how their behavioral coach, therapist, psychiatrist should be, not a year at a time or not taking a guess, right? So it's like, okay. And then me and product, we get together and we work together about how to get those people to complete those 30-day surveys. Because at the end of the day, that company wants to be in a measurement-based care model and they're growing. It's working. So again, you know,
it's a good positive note, though, I guess, to end on the fact that if we are seeing this shift in the fact that we were seeing the first 1,000 users get investment, if we're actually getting the first 1,000 outcomes get investment, and that causes this shift in quality towards companies that are doing the research, that are getting the data, that are being able to show the numbers. And then if the investors themselves are becoming more educated in this, and we are seeing this as well, we're seeing far more educated health tech investors, far better decisions being made, far better questions being asked in those due diligence processes. And, you know, plenty of clinicians are now becoming VCs and like all those different things. It's an incredible time to be in the space. Jen, it's been a pleasure. If you want to leave people with one thing, whether that's something from behavioral science, whether that's something else to do with the people that you're helping, even on in your company now, whether it's just a tip about being a CEO, what's one thing that you'd like to leave our audience with today?
It might sound a little cheesy maybe, but I would say, like, across being a CEO, being a leader, being a support team member for someone else's company, you know, being a scientist that's trying to grow or reach their what they want to do with their career. It's like, at the end of the day, it all comes back to the same thing. Is like, you have to know yourself and you have to listen to yourself. Like, you always have to do that, obviously with kindness and compassion, but you really have to listen to yourself because there's so much noise out there. And in all those situations, you'll be better at those things if you're listening to yourself, and exactly how I got to where I am. So
beautiful, beautiful. Jen, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening and making it all the way to the end of this episode.
Remember to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. And you can head to the description of this episode to follow me on all of my social media so you don't miss out on any of the latest health tech content.